So anywhere we get a more concrete connection between activity and results in knowledge work, we see vast differences than how the rest of us actually work. That's incredibly telling.
You're listening to the Elevate Podcast, and I'm your host, Robert Glazer. Join me as I talk to world-class performers about how they build their capacity and reach greater heights in leadership, business, and life, and how you can do the same.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. Our quote for today is from Carl Honoré. Slow does not mean doing everything at a snail's pace. It means doing everything at the right speed. My guest today, Cal Newport, is currently carrying the banner of a movement to slow down. Cal is an associate professor of computer science at Georgetown University. He's also the New York Times bestselling author of 8 books, including his latest, Slow Productivity, which debuted at number 2 on the NYT list a few weeks ago. Cal is also a contributing writer for The New Yorker and the host of the Deep Questions podcast. Cal, for the third time, welcome to the Elevate Podcast.
It's my pleasure to be here. I always look forward to writing books because I get to talk to you on the podcast.
And we will talk. So in some ways, actually, this is a continuation of your last appearance on the show back in 2022. You joined to talk about a world without email, but I think you also shared some breadcrumbs of a concept called slow productivity, which had become the subject and the title of your latest book. I know this, so this is obviously in your head for years before you wrote about it. What was the sort of genesis of the idea? And then, hey, I think this is a book.
Well, it came out of the pandemic, right? That's when the idea coalesced, even though the pieces had been in my writing and thinking for a long time. And what began to happen during the pandemic is I was hearing from more of my podcast listeners and my newsletter readers and book readers who were reaching this new point of frustration with their jobs. And these were primarily knowledge workers, so people who work at computer screens for a living. They were reaching this new point of frustration, almost nihilistic despair with their jobs, really indicating something's not right here. Like something is fundamentally broken about the way we think about being good at our jobs, being productive. And so it became a challenge for me to say, what is going on here? Why are they reaching this point of frustration? What has gone wrong? And then how do we fix it? And ultimately, this is what led to slow productivity emerging.
Yeah. I mean, you've written a lot of blogs, 8 books, dozens of New Yorker articles. And I know you talked about writing to workshop ideas. So what's the worthy versus not worthy threshold is it feedback from the market, as you said? Is it you don't want a solution in search of a problem? How do you know when it's worth the deep dive?
I mean, I'm constantly working on ideas, constantly live testing ideas. And there's a gut feeling that emerges at some point when what you're doing feels like it's right. So pretty early on, I started writing about the ideas that became slow productivity. I tested out different names for it, sort of implicitly. I explored different pieces of it on my newsletter at first. Then after a while, I wrote a New Yorker piece that was titled, It's Time to Embrace Slow Productivity. So sort of bringing out pieces of the idea to a larger audience.
And then it's very meta.
Yeah. And it's really what's coming back. And there was definitely, it was an idea that I was thinking about as a longer term idea. And the feedback I was getting from the audience told me at some point, this is urgent right now. And it became something that I actually ended up making my next project. Even though when I began conceiving it, I was more just open exploring this. But it was the feedback I was getting from my audience told me, no, the time is now for this idea.
And we're going to dive into this for a while, but I'm actually curious as you go through, because it was sort of a slow productivity process, saying no, was there other stuff along the way that got cut? Was there some stuff that was sort of neck and neck with it and then it got cut along the way and this kind of took over?
I mean, there's always a lot of ideas I'm working on, right? So, if you go back and look at what I'm writing and thinking about, there was a version of this idea, for example, like if we're going to get specific, there was a version of this idea that was titled something like The End of Busy. And it was focusing in particular on just like busyness, like having too much to do, this was a problem and how to get past it, and partially things we could do right now, but also looking to a technological future in which this is where we were going to aim digital office tools as the sort of a future where we didn't have this sense of being overloaded. Then that emerged eventually. It's like, wait, this is just sort of one of 3 pillars you need when you're thinking about how to control work. But that was like one direction this was going in at some point, was just focusing on the issue of busyness. And it broadened as I got more feedback from my audience about the full scope of the issue?
So slow productivity has three core tenets. Like, we'll dive into them individually. The first one is do fewer things. At the same time, I don't know a lot of people who do more than you. You're a tenured professor. You write books every couple of years. You have a podcast. You speak. Those are the things we see you do. I'm curious. You must say no to a ton of things. And then how do you re-engage around your current commitments and say, like, should I keep doing this? Because as you add something new, inevitably the plate gets bigger.
Well, I think the key to that advice is do fewer things at once. And why this is important is because everything that you're actively working on generates administrative overhead, right? So if I've agreed to do something and I'm actively working on it, it is going to generate administrative overhead, right? So this is going to be emails, this is going to be meetings. It is the aggregation of this administrative overhead that causes so many of the problems that knowledge workers are facing right now. So if you have too many things you're working on at once, more and more of your day is spent talking about the work. So you fall farther behind on the work. So what happens when you do fewer things at once? The pace at which you finish things picks up. Actually, you have more of your day to actually work on what you're working on. The quality of what you're working on goes up. So ironically, if you say, hey, I'm looking at your, Cal, I'm looking at what you're producing over the last 5 years, and there's like a lot of things in there. It is ironically doing fewer things at any one time that is what allows over time the aggregation of much more.
So there are a couple principles, tried and true principles, I think, embedded in this, right? How much are, there are two that I can think of that I think apply a lot in leadership. One's the 80-20 rule. Seems like we just can't get around that, no matter how much we try. Yep. And the other is this sort of, there's a lot of data around picking three goals, three objectives, and then organizations and teams that pick 10 quarterly goals get like none of them done because they're just have that light shooting in too many directions. So do you think those are sort of embedded within that?
I mean, I think those observations are universal, right now in knowledge work, right? I mean, the 80-20 rule, why is this so successful? Like, why has this been such a successful rule? It's because really what that's picking up is when you do too many things. So when you're working on that other 80 and not just the 20 that really matters, you get this proverbial or metaphorical logjam. So many things that are generating each of their own demands that are only tangentially related to the actual production of value. It's the meetings, it's the emails, it's the coordination with other people. When enough things are generating these sort of metaphorical logs, it jams up and then nothing is getting down the river. And so with 80-20, I think we often put too much emphasis on, things return different quantities of value. That's often how the Pareto principle is looked at, is some things are more important than others, so focus on the things that are more important. I actually now increasingly think the real value of 80-20 is that when you're doing more than 20% of the things you could be doing, you just jam things up and then very little gets done. That a big part of the actual explosion in value output you get when you focus on the 20 is less to do with the specific things you're focusing and more to do with the fact that you're doing fewer things. And so I think structurally, workload is fundamental to production. And yet in knowledge work, we think very little about workload. We leave it entirely up to individuals. We don't talk about it. If I'm a manager, I have no idea the full plate of what you're working on. It really is somewhat baffling that we ignore this sort of fundamental property of how the human brain as a machine actually produces things.
Well, there's also a couple of biases, a couple of things. One, you just made me think of, I share a lot. I think when we give other people things to do, they tend to operate on a LIFO basis, counting last in, first out, because they're subordinate and they assume that that must be most important than the other thing. I've always asked my assistants or otherwise or people to constantly, when I'm sensing they're like, bring me everything that we talked about and I'll reprioritize it for you. Like if you have questions about which things are more important, because what I used to see with someone is they would just work on the last thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I even argue, have an explicit queue. If we're going to do queues, right? We're going to talk about like LIFO versus right,
LIFO. One in, one out. Yeah.
Let's have a literal queue. And this is actually one of my suggestions is, okay, you have a list of the things you've agreed to work on. At the head of the list, you put a big dividing line, right? The first two or three things. These are things I'm actively working on. The rest of the list is an ordered queue. here's an order queue of things I'm going to work on next. And when I finish one of the active things, I will pull the next thing out of this queue and bring it into this active list. And if we want to reprioritize, we do this explicitly. We look at the queue and we move things around.
Right. We don't make more room. We reshuffle. Yeah.
Yeah. Or if a boss comes to you and says, okay, I want you to get this done, right? You can say, great. Let me just show you my workload. By default, I'd put this at the end of the queue, but let me know. You help me prioritize this. You know if it should be higher. And if you want me to be working on it right now, help me figure out which of the three active things to bump back to the queue. So you actually are involving all of the stakeholders in prioritization. You make it explicit as opposed to something just being implicit. This seems contrived, but actually the more we actually expose the structure of how we're doing workload management, like the much better experience we can actually have with our workloads. You can't fix something that you can't see.
With everyone fighting for attention these days, how can you get your business to stand out and connect with customers? It's easy. Get Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketing platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. Constant Contact makes it easy to promote your business with powerful tools like email and SMS marketing, social media postings, and even event management. You'll reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and communicate more effectively to sell more, raise more, and fast-track your growth. Constant Contact's writing assistance tools and automation features help you say the right thing at the right time, every time. Plus, you can send with confidence, knowing that your emails are actually reaching your customers, thanks to their best-in-class 97% deliverability rate. Constant Contact was actually the first email marketing platform I ever used almost 20 years ago, and it's a testament to the product's quality that it's still the standard for email marketing today. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Are you familiar with the sort of case study or I kind of referred to as the anti-case study of Marissa Meyer coming to Yahoo?
I wrote about this actually in The New Yorker back in 2020 when I was writing a piece about the history of remote work, and that was a central story. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, let's talk about this because the stats are kind of amazing. Marissa Meyer comes to, and I think the good news is this is changing a little bit. This is when people were celebrating no sleep and hero hours. But to me, not enough attention is given. So Marissa Meyer comes to Yahoo, I think in 2013, and she was a star at Google, like worked on some of their things. I happen to think she's probably one of these people who needs 4 hours of sleep a night biologically for some reason. You know, she starts dropping to the press that the secret of her success is 100-hour work weeks, 130-hour work weeks, which I didn't challenge anyone to do the math on that. Take out your calculator. You can't do it on a 5-day work week. And they said, well, how do you do that? And she said, well, you need to be strategic about your bathroom breaks and how you do meeting and when you eat or otherwise. 52 acquisitions later that were pretty much worthless, total destruction in stock value. It was, but wasn't clear. And she, a whole separate thing with building a nursery at work and otherwise. It's not that she didn't work hard, but there was zero outcome over 5 years of all that hard work.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think she personifies the essentially the villain of my book, with the philosophy of pseudo-productivity, which is, you know, in my mind, this is implicitly what we embrace when we think about productivity and knowledge work. What we really mean is pseudo-productivity, which is visible activity is our best proxy.
Yeah, like here past dinner, right? And that being, and look, what you incentivize implicitly or explicitly. Sometimes it's not even the financial incentive. It's what is the that a boy or that a girl, you know, go out for.
Yeah, and to be fair, one of the reasons why pseudo-productivity is so dominant in knowledge work is that the alternatives aren't obvious, right? Yeah. I mean, think about it for a second. When knowledge work emerged as a major sector in the 20th century, the models we had was essentially industrial manufacturing and agriculture. And there we had these very quantitative notions of productivity. I mean, productivity is a very clear thing.
You knew what output was.
You knew what output was.
Bing fell off the off the machine. Yeah.
But also, you know what input was, and you know the system that mediates between the two. If I'm running a Subaru factory, I can count the Subarus I can produce. I can count the number of labor hours per Subaru produced. And I know exactly what my production system is, right? And so I could go in there, like someone from the shop floor could say, hey, let's change this bit of the production process. We can do it, measure those two numbers again. And if it goes up, say, great, that's better. So you have this sort of super clear way of aggressively increasing and experimenting productivity. None of that works in knowledge work. We're not producing Subarus. We're doing 20 things and it's different than your things. And there's no clear processes we're running. So we just fell back on Marissa Meyer. Let's use her as the standard. More is better than less. I mean, that was what was driving her, right? Is like, okay, if activity is what matters, I will out activity everyone, which means I must be the best CEO, which of course she wasn't. Because as you said, that company fell apart, where on the other hand, you have, you know, whether you love or hate what he's doing with Twitter, you have someone like Elon Musk who was running five companies, meaning that he was given significantly less time to each of those. And yet, you know, SpaceX became a massive success. Tesla became a massive success. So it tells you it can't be an hour game. Activity can't be the thing that ultimately really alchemizes in the value. And I think knowledge work is just starting to realize this.
You said something there that crystallized it for me. Generally, if all the parts in the manufacturing were well lubricated and maintained and proactively, if you turned up the speed and you fed more stock, more things came out of the other end.
Yep.
So I think maybe we just learned that intellectually, but it just doesn't work in knowledge work and in services. It doesn't have that linear. There's so much going on that you can't see or touch. But I could see how that's how people got the belief that you just turn up the volume.
Yeah. And another interesting point here is I think critics of modern productivity, there's a lot of sort of anti-worker critics of even using the word productivity. Trust me, they're not happy with me having that title in my book, even though my book is about escaping pseudo-productivity. Something they often misunderstand about productivity as a general economic concept is that they're always using Frederick Winslow Taylor as this sort of archetype of this is what we've internalized, this is what productivity means, right? And so Taylor is famous for doing scientific management, for sitting there with a stopwatch and trying to find the most efficient movements for the workers. And his famous case study was figuring out the exact ideal shovel head size for shoveling iron slag, that you're maximizing iron slag shoveled while minimizing the chance of an injury that takes that person, you know, out of commission. But here's the reality. Even in the industrial sector, Frederick Winslow Taylor was not that influential. Like, he was a bit of a crackpot. He had these sort of weird theories. It didn't work well. What actually dominated in industrial productivity was more the Ford notion of make the system better. So like, actually, the notion that dominated in industrial productivity was the assembly line produces stuff much better than this other way we were doing it. Whereas the Taylorist approach, which was just focused on the individual doing their task faster, that actually never really had much legs in the industrial sector. So it's interesting. We have this boogeyman of Taylor. It's like we've adopted that mindset, even though even in the industrial sector, he wasn't that influential. Right. But we somehow think in the knowledge sector that there's something to this. If we could just be faster, if we could just move faster. That has not been the secret to productivity anywhere. It wasn't the secret to productivity in agriculture either. Like the various agricultural revolutions of the past 1,000 years, none of them were based on farmers moving faster. None of them were based on farmers working longer hours. They were all based actually on smarter crop rotation systems or better stock or better tools for cultivating and tilling fields. It was systems. So it's like we have this boogeyman when we think about knowledge work productivity. We've internalized this, like, we got to be faster and we got to move quicker and have tools that make everything go faster. We kind of made that up because we didn't even really understand what productivity was. So that just makes us in an even worse situation.
Well, it's also a little bit because of, I think, this over-reliance on the input orientation and not the outcome. And what's interesting to me is that people in sales are really good at the outcome. They don't want the salesperson that makes 100 calls a week and sells 1,000. If they sell 10 calls a week and sell 10,000, you'd take that person every time. Someone once said to me, there are a bunch of metrics that you would have. Like, if your car goes into the shop, you look at like the speedometer and the gas generally, you know, to see if you're okay. If it doesn't work, there are a whole bunch of diagnostics you can go into, but day to day, you don't need all those diagnostics. So if the salesperson's failing, I might look at their calls and otherwise and try to understand why are they failing. But fundamentally, I judge them by sales. I found that other departments and functions can't figure out those same outcome things. They seem to orient around input things.
Yeah. Well, let me make that even more concrete. You mentioned sales. I was talking at a book event I did a couple of weeks ago. Someone in sales from a major tech company came up to talk to me, right? And what he said was really interesting. He said, you know what? At our company, the sales staff doesn't have to go to meetings. It's optional for the sales staff, right? This was actually really profound because what was going on in the company was the sales staff was really the only part of the company where you had an objective metric, like you have in a car manufacturing plant. How much sales are you doing? As soon as you had an exact a metric,
then it wasn't worth going to meetings. Yeah.
Sort of productivity there, like get rid of that. Like, no, you don't have to go to meetings and answer all these emails. Like, go sell. That's what we care about. So what that tells me is part of why pseudo productivity persists is because in so many other types of knowledge work positions, we can't count sales dollars, right? It's more, I work on 10 different things and it's some's internal and some's external. And as soon as you get rid of those metrics, what comes in? Well, let's just, you know, I can control being busy. I can demonstrate activity by sending emails and chats and jumping on Zooms. And we just fall back onto that.
And people reward, they don't realize they're rewarding it, but they reward when the managers start, I mean, not even explicitly, but implicitly rewarding that behavior.
Yep.
Then everyone starts emulating it.
Yeah. And think about what is the other knowledge work sector where we get away from this? Well, there was also computer programming, right? That a lot of computer programming shops realized we have to like ship this update to this software and we have to get it done. And like the number one thing that drives this is like these coders producing really good code as quickly as possible. There's a direct connection between what they're doing and us making deadlines. So what do you see in computer programming shops? They get rid of this whole, just let's just send email and have meetings all days. And they adopt these agile methodologies, right? Where it's, you work on one thing at a time and it's up on the board. And in the morning, we get together for 5 minutes and say, what do you need to get this thing done? Great. We will leave you alone until you finish this. We'll take care of what work is incoming. We'll keep it over here on a board. Just do this one thing. Because you know what? That's the most effective way to actually change brain activity in the computer code, is to just let programmers work on one thing at a time with their full concentration. So anywhere we get a more concrete connection between activity and results and knowledge work, we see vast differences than how the rest of us actually work. That's incredibly telling.
I want to go back to this concept of saying no for a second, because I think a lot of people are good at saying no when they're fully committed and literally can't take on more and are stressed. One of the arguments you make is, and I think what people don't do well is, how do you know what to say no when you still have capacity? Because, you know, what we're trying to do is leave space for the right things to come along. And if we fill it with the 80, then we'll never have time for the 20. That seems to be a huge challenge for people.
Oh, it's a huge one, especially in modern knowledge work, exactly because we don't have any sort of formalized system for workload management. It's on you to figure it out. But there's a few things that help here, right? Okay, first, never give a yes or no in the room. So you really want to take the social capital imbalance out of the equation. The sort of the boss has put his hand on your shoulder. You know, hey, Robert, I want you to do this for me, right? It's very difficult to say no to someone in the eye. So get in the habit of always saying, like they do in Hollywood, that sounds great. You know, this sounds really useful. Like exact type of thing I could do well. Great. Let me, you know, I keep a very tight shop in terms of managing like my time and projects. So I'll go run this through my system as soon as I get a moment and I'll get back to you and see if we can fit this in. So you're not saying yes or no in the room and you're establishing right away your credentials as someone who's very organized about your time and your work so that now you can come back later, like 3 hours later and say, however you're managing this, okay, I reality check this. I'm looking at my load. I don't actually have the time to complete. It would be like 4 or 5 weeks till I can find the time to do this, or I'd have to bump one of these things. So, you know, should I bump one of these? Or maybe actually this is, I don't really have the capacity right now, but it's a good idea. You can then give the evidence-based no outside of the room.
That second part is key. And I have coached people on this, particularly we've been in client services for years, right? The assumption that we can just take on more. You go back and say, look, which thing do you want us to stop doing? And sometimes it's this distraction. Can you jump into this new market? I can, but we'd have to take out some of the money out of this market that's actually producing right now. Or I could add more people to the team and charge you more. Which do you want? And then they go, oh, well, you know, when you replay it back to them, and I say, why is it bad for that person? No one cares why stuff is bad for the other person. They care for themselves. So you need to replay it back and say, I don't have more capacity, so I could spend more money, or I could not do one of these other things, right?
I mean, here's a way to implement that idea that means you never have to even give an explicit no, is go back to what we talked about before. Here's my list, my sort of public Kanban board. I'm working on this actively. Here's my cue. You say, great, this sounds great. Tell me, like, because you're the one who knows what's going on here, you're the boss. Tell me where you want me to put this. And you could even have, and this really impresses people, is in your cue, you have these vertical marks you've put in there with time estimates. Like, I think we're going to get to this point probably like 3 weeks from now. Like, past this point, we'll probably be to this point. This is like a month from now, right? So you kind of have these time estimates in there. It looks so professional. You're like, yeah, just show me where you want me to put that in there. It's not confrontational. It's actually like I'm tapping your wisdom, right? And then this is, you're never saying no in this, with this system. And they're either like, put it at the end or put it near the front and bounce this back, right? Or swap out something active. Or when you do this 5 times out of 10, you know what? It's not really that important. Like, keep doing what you're doing. Actually, that's more important. You know what? I don't want to get in the way of these other things. So you make your workload transparent. You integrate your boss and colleagues and clients into the actual prioritization. When you're a black box that just like stuff goes in.
Yeah. And there's something implicit in what you're saying is, I think a lot of people think there's this whip driving boss. They just might not remember the other 7 things they asked you to do.
Yes. And what I found is like 9 bosses out of 10, like, what is the service you're providing your boss? Like, most bosses, like you're saying, they're not mustache twirling. They're not, it's like, I really hate people and want to make their life hard because capitalism or something, right? They're not, right? I mean, they're typically reasonable people. I mean, some are jerks, but that's true in everything.
Yeah.
What is it that they want you to do for them? What's the problem you're solving for them? It's not, I need someone to answer emails quickly. It's not, I need someone just to do what I say right away. The problem you are solving for them is that when something comes into their world that needs to get done that they're not going to do, it is a source of anxiety and stress. Your job is to take that anxiety and stress away from them. That's your job. Now, if you're disorganized or there's no clarity about what's going on and you're just like this black box or whatever, the only way you're going to be able to take that anxiety and stress away from them is to finish the thing. They're going to say, I don't trust you to do this. I have to stay worried about this until you finish it. So I'd rather you just do it right now. And I'm going to keep bothering you until you do it, because I can't, as the boss, release this anxiety and stress till I trust this is done. But if you're organized and you show them that cue and they place it in position 6, they might not care that's going to take a month, because you've solved their problem. I don't have to worry about this anymore. Look how organized Robert is. It's right there. I can actually check in and watch it march forward. He's going to tell me as soon as it gets onto his active list and say, great, let's meet now and talk about it. You have solved my problem. My problem is not getting things done immediately. My problem is getting stress out of my life.
Right. This is that LIFO problem. I think there is a default to this life last in, first out. And I don't know. It's just, no one has said it, but everyone defaults to assuming that.
Yeah. But also people, the recipients get stressed as well. If you're not organized about your workload management, when something comes on your plate, you're like, I'm now stressed that someone asked me to do this and they're waiting for it. I kind of want to just do this until it goes away, because I can make this new stress go away. So let me just like do the new thing as quickly. But if you have a system where I know exactly where this is, things move, you get the same benefit of, this will get done. This will get done. I'm not going to lose it. I'm not going to forget about it. I don't have to just frenziedly work in the moment till it's gone. It is safe. This is like a David Allen principle. The loop is closed. It's in a trusted system. I can find some zen.
So that brings us to the second principle, is to work at a natural pace. So that's a very, not a word used maybe in this context. So it is the idea of natural vary greatly from person to person, task to task, or is there some general standard of natural?
Well, it's more, there's a very clear definition of unnatural.
Right? Okay.
Unnatural is, I'm going to work at full intensity all day long and do that year round.
Yeah.
That is very unnatural for humans, right? We are used to having a huge amount of variation in intensity over different time scales with the work we're doing. It wasn't until mills and factories came along in the 18th and 19th century that for the first time in human history, we really tried this idea of like, what if you just worked hard all day long and that just didn't change throughout the year? And it was so unbearable that we had to create labor unions and whole regulatory frameworks just to make that type of work tolerable. Then knowledge work comes along. We're like, yeah, let's just do the factory thing. Like, we'll gather in offices and we should be working hard all day long and just never vary that throughout the year. When you get away from pseudo productivity, you also then need to get away from trying to work all out all day long. You can get away with that when what you're really doing is talking about work and sending emails and jumping in meetings. But once you're actually just really working and most of your day is not talking about work, you can't go all out every day. So we have to be more personally and organizationally tolerant of its ups and downs throughout the week, throughout the month, throughout the year.
Well, think about what if a lot of the athletes have all settled on is high interval training, right? Yeah. That you can't, you need to train, rest, recover, train, like it, that's how the human body works. And then look, it seems like the longer you keep your foot on the gas in the knowledge work space, the bigger the crash eventually, right? Mm-hmm.
And it pushes you more towards pseudo productivity because it's the only thing you can try to keep up with, right? Because you can't sit there and just think as hard as you can and do really hard stuff all day long. Like you can't do that day after day. So what happens is, as you get more burnt out, is you just spend more and more of your time email slacking and meetings, right? So it has this insidious side effect of less good stuff gets produced. And one of the ways I looked at this is I said, let's study people who produced value with their mind that didn't work in offices, who were freed from pseudo productivity, who could do it however they wanted. What do we see? They're up and down in intensity. The different times of the year are different. They take way longer to finish things. And yet when we zoom out, we're like, oh my God, they're so productive. Look at all this awesome stuff they're producing. Like the recipe for producing awesome stuff with your brain is you take longer on projects, you go up and down in intensity, you craft things that really matter.
It's always on a walk or on a shower that you tend to have this breakthrough, right? I mean, how many people say, oh, I was on a walk, right? You know, I wasn't doing anything and the key creative moment or breakthrough came.
Yeah. You're on a walk, you're in a shower, or at a bigger time scale in the summer, these people would go somewhere different and they're walking, that changes, that opens things up, different types of work for different times.
That's interesting because change of venue has been a huge thing for me. And right, that is so counterintuitive to come in the office, sit in the chair, do the thing, right?
Yeah, we forget how unnatural that is. It only works because of pseudo productivity, because I can sit there and do emails all day, which is basically, and Zoom, and that's basically what we do, but we don't remember how unnatural it was to start doing that with mills and factories. It was like a huge thing that created huge counter protest movements. It was, it was like a rift in the way that we operate as humans. It's not natural to just sit and do the same thing all day. That's especially if you're trying to do high order cognitive work.
Yeah. And Dan Pink covered that a little bit in his book, When, about even times of day and doing different things. And you're right. Your times when you're cognitively sharp and there are times that are better for meeting, but there's an oscillation to it.
Yeah. Yeah. And we need to acknowledge that.
All right. The third principle is obsess over quality. At this point, you've been a published writer for 20 years. Like, how do you stay sharp and ensure that you're getting better? What are your kind of quality control metrics?
I mean, I always think about it. I always think about how do I become a better writer, right? As soon as you stop caring about your central craft and start caring about all the periphery around it, that's when you're going to stagnate or even fall backwards. That's when exhaustion is going to creep in. It's when pseudo productivity is going to creep in. Like, the more you care about your craft, the more intolerant you become for busyness. The less you care about your craft, the more you find comfort in the warm digital embrace of busyness. So for me, I've always been I want to make my writing better, right? And so for a while, it had to do with each book being more ambitious in its sort of underlying intellectual structure and scope. You know, starting about 5 years ago, starting to write for The New Yorker became a big piece of this because that really pushed me. Now I'm sort of expanding the types of pieces I write for The New Yorker to try to expand my writer muscles. So I'm always trying to get better. Just craft for craft's sake is at the core of my professional efforts.
So as you walk through the three things, at face value, it could seem that slow productivity might be more applicable for people who have professional autonomy, right? Solopreneurs, business owners, craftspeople, skilled work, they're so good that they can work at their own pace. How does this get applied to people with less autonomy, you know, rank and file? It seems like it's up to their manager or their leader to make a change versus they might have the ability to make a change.
All right, this is the thread that goes through, you know, all of my work about work, which is the definition, like one of the core definitions of knowledge work is there is a massive amount of autonomy that individuals have, right? Because in knowledge work, unlike other sectors, how you do your work, how you manage your workload, how you organize your time, how you figure out to say yes or what you say no to. All of this is left up to the individual.
Individual, the worker, or individual, the individual leader who worker. Tells the worker what to do. Yeah.
Very few knowledge workers, people who work with their brain for a living, have a boss to say, here's how you should organize your tasks. What's your workload? Here's how many things you should be working on. Here is how you should collaborate about work, you know, what your interaction pattern. All of that is left to the individual. This is fundamental to knowledge work. This is Peter Drucker in the late 50s and early 60s banging the drum and saying autonomy, autonomy, autonomy. That's what defines knowledge work. So that same autonomy that allows us to get completely overloaded, because look, if no one's controlling workloads, if there's no systems for how this is going to work, you can really get into trouble. That same autonomy that helps create the problems of pseudo-productivity also enables our way to get out. Right? In a world where it's up to you to figure out how to manage your workload, your time, and your work habits, you can decide to do those in a way that's going to be much less pseudo-productive. And so it's like exactly what we were talking about with workload.
Here's what I'm going to do, like focus on what I'm going to do and not how I do it or when I'm here or otherwise, right?
Yeah. And also just like think about what we said with the project queue. All right, great. Let's do this. Where do you want me to put that in there? Like this is a system where you are now controlling that you only have a few things you're working on actively at a time. Everything else queues up. This is going to significantly reduce the overhead you face every day. You're going to become much more productive in terms of how quickly you produce things. Your boss is going to be happy with you. They're going to be happy that you have your act together with all this stuff.
Yeah.
Right? In knowledge work, you can do that. In the industrial work, you can't. You can't go to your Subaru plant and say, look, I have a whole different way that I want to put the steering wheels on the car.
Yeah.
Like, no. This is all structured. You don't have any choice in this. In knowledge work, we forget the degree to which this is essentially everything is up to you in terms of how you execute your work. Maybe you can't control what they're asking you to do, but you can control what you do with that, how you structure it, how you work on it, what you work on, what you don't work on, how you prioritize, how you communicate. All of this is up to you. You have a huge number of levers to pull in knowledge work that we don't have elsewhere. You need to pull them.
So we seem to be coming off a decade of fast, of fast and hollow growth and probably defined by pseudo productivity. And not only are people working too much, nonstop, the wrong thing, but they're just focused on adding and it's getting a lot of tape and a lot of hidden complexity. For the people not paying attention at home, and again, I am not advocating that layoffs are good or otherwise, but I think people need to look carefully at what has happened at these tech companies. After years of just hiring and throwing people at problems, they have been, you know, let's say laying off 10% of their employees. And you might assume with that that you saw a 10% jump in profit. You see a tripling of profit or a doubling of profit. And you know, I know because people don't like to talk about this and it seems like they're advocating for layoffs or whatever, but it's kind of staggering. And I've heard this from people that reducing something thinking they were taking out some costs suddenly added layers of growth and productivity. And I not only this would be a slogan of why it's not the time for quiet quitting, but I just think that like people have to be looking at this being like, huh, that is not the outcome we expected when we got rid of 10% of the employees.
I mean, part of what's happening inside these big tech companies is they had this entrepreneurial model for employees, like this idea of like, you're all independent contributors, you figure out what you want to do, generate KPIs, and we'll sort of like track that you get those done. And it just became a lot of people gaming that system. Like, okay, so I can do whatever I want to do, and I'm going to be evaluated by how I hit the objectives I created. Great. What I'm going to do is not going to be helping the company. I'm going to create nonsense projects so I can spend the first half of the year like building this nonsense project and the second half of the year like fixing all the mistakes in the nonsense project. And this is going to have me like draw in other people's attentions and resources. It was the flaw with this idea that, hey, the people who started these companies were these like great independent entrepreneurs. So let's keep that spirit alive. That doesn't work when you have 30,000 employees. So I think, yeah, there's something telling here about the disconnect between how we're working and actual results. It's not just you're a smart guy, you're a smart woman, like go for it, like just go do stuff. Like that doesn't actually, after a certain scale, produce bottom line results. So I think it's very interesting. You're absolutely right what we're seeing with the tech companies right now.
Well, also there's clearly a bureaucratic or red tape cost, right? Where all of these things are just holding things down, slowing everything down. It's in that, you know, 80 bucket that's only 20%. I just, the numbers are actually staggering. And I've heard it on a smaller level where people say, you know what, things were tight and so we cut 10%. And so I was expecting, you know, just to see a 10% cost reduction, but suddenly revenue started, just not the expectation, at all. Maybe how many of these people were doing things that just didn't matter? And yeah, it's not that they weren't working hard. Maybe some were quiet quitting and working 10 hours a week. But this is it's possible to be working on 80 hours of something that A, doesn't matter to the couple things you should be doing, but B, steals resources from things that do. And so suddenly there's a halo effect, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what they were doing is if you can get above a performance curve, you get a bigger bonus, but the performance curve is measured on the quantity and rate at which you're accomplishing these objectives, but you came up with the objectives. So of course, to work on something really hard that could fundamentally alter the company, but might take 3 years, you're not going to do that. You're going to do sort of nonsense because you can churn through the objective that you created.
And no one's aligning those objectives, like for all the KPIs and OKRs, like it doesn't roll into a pyramid of supporting the highest level objectives.
No, a lot of these companies, it's free for all. It's like we hire the smartest people and we pay them well, go do stuff. And I've been surprised actually to discover the degree that that's true at a lot of the big tech companies right now. It's not, there's not this tightly controlled, you know, Microsoft in the 1990s type setup or like, this is the thing we're doing. And like, we're ruthlessly identifying the people that can help us get Windows NT launched this year or whatever, that sort of ruthless results oriented, performance oriented. It's way more of a free for all. Their companies are so large and there's so much profit sloshing around. And it's, I think it's crazier than people realize.
Yeah, I think leaders are generally surprised. Again, maybe it's not a layoff, but maybe it's stopping a project or shutting down something or whatever. There is this fear to stop doing something. And there is generally a shock that when it is gone, not only is it not missed, but it was a net negative.
Yeah, which, by the way, is a big slow productivity principle, right? Like, what do you see when you hone down, you reduce the number of missions, I call it, that you're working on?
Right.
The quality of the things that are left goes up. And typically that quality going up on what's left is going to be a much bigger win than having more things that are being done at a low level of quality. It's sort of this back to this 80-20 thing, like focus on the things that really matter, do them really well. It applies at the organizational level as much as it does for individuals.
So look, we're in this AI moment, this algorithm-driven content area. It seems like so many content creators are dedicated to pumping out low quality at a frenzied pace. We know we're all going to get sales outreach from really well-written AI things kind of all day long. Like, do you think that we'll be able to put the toothpaste back into the tube in terms of quality and graduality? Or a lot of things that we're doing, and particularly AI, just feels volume-oriented. AI seems to be a lot more about volume than quality.
Yeah, I think what it's going to do is in content creation, there's these whole segments of what I call checklist productivity, where someone's like, here's the system, generate these Twitter threads in this format. And at the end of the Twitter thread, say, hey, if you like this and want to hear more, make sure you subscribe. There's these sort of like schemes, like do these things, pick a topic, do it this way, do it 10 times a week. Like you can just check off and do these things. They have this promise that you'll then be making a living as a content producer. So like a lot of people are doing this in various this sort of like a lower end quality content creation world. Generative AI will probably wipe that out as a segment for individuals to pursue, because I could just have generative AI produce those things and then we're just going to flood the market with those things. And then there's no real market.
Competitive advantage. It's ironic because it doesn't seem to be a competitive advantage if everyone can do that cheaply, right?
Exactly. So what is going to matter? Producing good stuff, which by the way, is sort of what the market was pre-internet anyways, was like, yeah, there wasn't, The slots for like producing content that's read at a very large market were sort of scarce because it was very competitive and you had to be a very good journalist to get a spot at Time Magazine. And then the internet made it possible for like anyone to produce content, and AI is going to sort of help make it excessively non-profitable to try to do that at a lower quality level. And it's almost like we're going to be back in like 1993 Mediascape of like, okay, if you can do what you do really well, that'll once again, you know, continue to be valued.
So I'm curious, as you wrote the book and have looked around, like who's doing it right? Who are some of the companies that seem to be embracing, or the leaders embracing slow productivity? Or what are sort of the tactics that leaders who are championing slow productivity are using?
Like the two things you'll see that I think are always good signs is either explicit workload management or like a much more outcome-based view of production, right? So the explicit workload management, I mean, we see this more, you know, in places like software development, but it's beginning to expand to other types of knowledge work, which is great. which is this idea of like work that needs to be done doesn't exist by default on individuals' plates. We keep it in a central place for a team, and we explicitly manage how many of these things is an individual working on at once. It's not up to you to keep track of all these things. You work on the thing one or two things at a time.
So it's like a library. You can check out two books at a time.
You can check out two books at a time, or they're doing sprint methodologies outside of software. Like this team is working on this for the next 2 days. You can't even reach them by email. I think that's going a long way. And then we have a more outcome focused companies like, okay, here's what I want you to work on. You're working on this. We're going to really, you know, care about it. We're going to look at what you produced, right? I mean, accountability is going to be now put into place, but also we don't now expect you to be plugged into a general hyperactive hive mind hum of just like little requests and things going back and forth. So this idea, companies that are getting away from this idea of like everyone is this general purpose processor that's plugged into this mesh, we're all just doing a bunch of stuff. The companies that are getting away from that, like, no, actually you're writing white papers for us. Just write the white papers, you know, We don't need you to be sort of just generally have cognitive cycles available for people to rent to do other things. These are the places where a slower notion of productivity is arising. I actually heard from someone at one of these companies recently where he was really struggling because he just moved to one of these companies where they really say, do this thing well, that's all we care about. And he's beside himself because he's like, what do I do all day? Yeah, like, because he'll work for like 3 or 4 hours. Like make a lot of progress.
Yeah, and then you need a break.
And then he's like, what do I do? Because he was used to in his old job, like being frenzied all day long. And you know, my advice for him, this was a call in my podcast. I was like, you're done for the day. Your 4 hours is like, you're moving the needle. Get a hobby, basically, I told him, right? Like figure out something else to learn about. That's what slow productivity in an extreme can look like.
And what about constraints? So you have the European version of constraints, like you can't email after hours or, you know, 5 o'clock or you have, you know, and it's interesting. I haven't heard about it as much now in the last 9 months I think about it, but the 4-day work week, like, do these help or do they just shift around the problem?
They help, but not enough, right? So, yeah. I mean, my metaphor would be, if people keep coming in with like rashes on their arms, these laws are like, we have a very good like cream to put on it to like stop the itching and good bandages while it's healing. That's fine. But like ultimately what you want to do is say like, where is this poison ivy patch out there that people keep hitting? We need to get rid of that. This is ultimately what we need to do in knowledge work is move away from pseudo productivity. So saying like, don't email me after certain hours, or I want an extra day of recovery. Like this is just escaping or trying to constrain a work setup that's bad. So the bigger solution here is let's make the work setup better, right? So in like industrial manufacturing, for example, just by definition, working on an assembly line is bad for humans. We talked about it. It's very unnatural. It's very draining. Yeah. So the way you think about that is how do we constrain how much time you have to do this and make sure you're compensated a lot for doing this because it's pretty terrible. But in knowledge work, we have this other knob to turn as well, which is make the work less bad. You can't make working on an assembly line less bad. It's tedious. But you can make knowledge work less bad.
You can make it fun, right?
I don't know.
Well, there's a famous story about U.S. Steel, right, where they all started writing the number of things that they got done, shifts, and it just became a kind of healthy competition, and it worked better than any other productivity thing that they had put in place.
Yeah. Though I think the workers hate that story. It's a story where they just naturally realize we should be working harder. Yeah, I mean, it's always obviously the tension in there, but there's not much you can do to like fundamentally make moving the slag iron better. But in knowledge work, the equivalent of that, we could get rid of. It's like being on email all day, being on meetings all day. Like this is the thing that's bringing us down, and we don't really need that.
Yeah, I've noticed when I'm on Zoom a couple hours a day, I need a nap or I'm tired. Like it's cognitively draining. So have you seen the data? It's interesting. I didn't think about it, but it probably has quieted down with the labor market cooling down. The thing that always scared me about the 4-day work week is I think if it didn't work in a company, it's really hard to ever go back on something like that once you've done it. And so if it doesn't work, you're kind of stuck. I also think it works better for companies, say in manufacturing than client service or otherwise, where you're like, wait, we can't talk to people on Friday. You know, it's different. But I'm curious, is there actual data on this? Because everyone to me was jumping in with 2 feet without any data on, you know, there's always a short-term effect of a change, but is there some long-term effect on whether this has made any difference or not?
It hasn't been around long enough. Like the big data they have from the Iceland study and from the UK study is essentially people saying, yes, I'm happier working less days. Like, surprisingly, you ask the employees, they say they're happy with it. I'll tell you my suggestion, which I think would be way more effective than the 4-day work week in terms of improving the experience of workers, is start with a hybrid schedule, which has the data now shows that's become by far the most common work configuration now. Like, that's how we ended up post-pandemic. Hybrid schedule is by far the most common configuration. Okay, take a hybrid schedule, synchronize the at-home days, and add one more rule. No meetings on the at-home days, no email at the at-home days. Do that. I call this hybrid attention. This is going to have, I think, a much bigger positive impact on individuals and output than just taking a day out of the week. That there's 2 days in the week where I'm just home working on things and there's no meetings and there's no emails. And the other 3 days I'm in the office and we can have meetings, and those meetings are going to be way more efficient because we can also have 6 other side discussions while we're there and save ourselves 100 emails. And we get this sort of clarity and progress on projects and escape from the context switching, but still quite a bit of coordination. I think hybrid attention, we're so close to it. We're already doing the hybrid schedule. Just add that extra rule. I wrote an Atlantic article about this a few weeks
ago. Right, because what you're effectively saying is you need quiet time and you need group time in the office. And like, the group time is hard to do at home, but the quiet time is as easy to do at home as it is to go lock yourself in your office at work. And I think you're right. We've settled on hybrid. However, early in the pandemic, I was sort of giving the advice to people, look, it doesn't matter which version of hybrid you pick, just pick something and support it, because otherwise people don't know what you're going to do. I agree with you. I think the hybrid where you just have to be in any 2 days doesn't make any sense, right? Because now you're missing the human connection and all the stuff that people are missing, and you can't organize around that, versus to say, generally, you know, we're all going to be in on Wednesdays and Thursdays. And you know what? We're going to do the new hire introductions then, and we're going to do the partner meeting then, and the things that actually we're going to do the brainstorm make more sense, and sort of what you said. So I think companies have definitely started to gravitate around that model, makes more sense. I the work any one day of the week doesn't seem to get you the benefits that you're looking for.
Well, I think the problem is employers, this is where they differ from employees, were thinking about and continue to think about working from home as a benefit. Like, I'm giving you dental coverage, right?
Yeah.
So like, okay, so we'll give you, how much of this benefit do I need to give you to keep you? Okay, you can choose it. So they're still seeing it as good for you, bad for me, which is the only way to why they would say, you can choose a week to do this, right? It's like saying, you know, you can, we'll give you a bonus, or we'll give you this extra whatever. And as opposed to thinking about, this is the fundamental structure of our collaboration. It's like hybrid attention. It's not, okay, we're going to give you guys this bonus of like these 2 days you can choose when to work at home. We're saying, no, actually switching back and forth like this is going to be a better way to run the company.
Well, it's also the oscillation that you said, it kind of solves some of the problems of being on the assembly line to begin with, right? And doing the same thing all week.
Yeah.
But all of that also works better with this outcome orientation, right? If you know what the outcome is of those meetings that you want people in them, and you know the outcome of why, you know, kind of like, all right, we talked about which story we're going to go with in the Atlantic, you know, in our in-person meeting. And like, now I need you to go write the story tomorrow.
Yeah. And by the way, you can also, if you're worried about accountability, it's fine if like, here's what we do on the at-home days. Okay, there's no meetings or emails with the following exception. At the beginning of the day, you jump onto a team call like you would do with a scrum and just like very quickly say, here's what I'm doing today. And at the end of the day, you jump back on a call and say, here's how it went, right? So, I mean, managers have this fear that's semi-justified that, wait, if I can't bother you, how do I know that you're not at the ball game all day? That's how you do it. They say, this is what I'm working on today. At the end of the day, so here's the report.
You create some accountability.
Yeah.
I was at a conference talking about remote work right after this. And a woman in the audience was like, so I've been, you know, I'm not a micromanager, but I've had made my team stay on Zoom all day, you know, so that they can see each other and I can see them. And so what do you think about that? And I was like, and I had read the data on it. I'm like, I'm not sure. I'm not sure you want me to answer this in front of like 250 other people, but that is a horrible thing to do.
Yeah. Well, that's also crystallized pseudo productivity. If visible activity is what matters, then what is your reaction to remote work? Let's make sure that we can still have visibility on activity.
Right. And you want to talk about a bad cat and mouse game. So what's the productivity software tracking thing that most companies install? It's keyword and mouse movement tracker. What's one of the top sellers on Amazon? An automatic mouse mover. if you are tracking your employees for keyboard and mouse movement and they are buying automatic mouse movers and keyboard things, you have lost whatever game you're playing or whatever industry you're in.
Yeah. But also, you don't need those trackers, because I do think the it's a clean idea. So we talk about it a lot, though it's not actually that widespread. But it's not that widespread because you don't need it. Because in a pseudo productivity environment, my equivalent of a keyboard mouse tracker is how quickly you respond to my emails, how quickly you're responding to my Slacks, how many meetings do I see you in? And the employees know it. And so your whole time that you're home, this is why people did not get that assumed improvement in terms of stress and subjective well-being that they thought the shift to remote work would give them during the pandemic. Part of why they didn't get that is that in some sense, the frenetic activity got worse, because it's how we, you better be answering, because like, how else do I know you're working and I can't see you? It really made things worse. There's no more equivalent of, oh, your office door is shut. I'll wait till I see you getting coffee to bother you about something. It just, everything became all at once, everything loud all at once. It was like the movie that won Best Picture last year. That's what office work became, but in like a much worse, less kung fu cool way.
So one of the ironic things we've talked about is that you've in some ways become famous for never having created a social media account. If we want to talk about things that destroy productivity, you're also a parent in an era where kids are getting exposed early and earlier to technology and social media. I'm sure you've thought about how are you going to approach that when your kids kind of reach that age. And look, at least you're able to say, I don't do it. Where most of the parenting is do as I say, not as I do these days.
Yeah. Well, look, I think the research is becoming increasingly clear. The appropriate, in some sense, the safe age to give someone unrestricted access to the internet, including social media accounts, is 16, which right now the kids still hate, but I think we're like 2 years away from that just being the cultural standard.
It's like beer. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, if your kid needs communication, like a text messaging or this or that, that be picked up from school, you know, the payphones we use as kids are gone, that type of thing. There, I think the best practice is when your kid actually has a demonstrated practical need, then you can get them a phone that doesn't have the internet. Unrestricted internet access should be 16, right? No, here's your iPad at home you can do what you want with. Here's your phone that you can have whatever you want on there. This dream that like, well, I'll give you the phone, but put these parental protections on it. Yeah, right? Right. I mean, you give kid a phone with a piece of software blocking them from YouTube, they're going to be hacking the mainframe within like 9 minutes. Yes. Like they are going to figure out how to whatever solder a bypass chip onto the motherboard. And I've been tracking this closely. You know, I know John Haidt and I've sort of been following along with him and talking to him about his growing research bib. And he has a new book out about this. I think he's right. 16 is where we're going to end up. That's when you say, yeah, here's just a thing that gives you access to the internet. Do what you want on it. That's when that first becomes appropriate.
How old is your oldest child?
Only 11.
11. So I'll preview the number one thing that kids say and that parents come and say, I don't know how to deal with this because I'm curious your answer. Whatever the app is, let's say it's Snapchat or otherwise, the kids will say, look, my friends all have it and they're all making, let's call it the Acme app. They're all making plans in the Acme app or in the Acme chat. And like, if I am not in that, like, I'm not going to get invited and I'm going to be excluded. I've heard this from multiple parents, and this is the thing. Like, look, I'm comfortable with telling them you don't need to be going through, you know, Snapchat or Instagram or TikTok or whatever. But this problem of this is where they're coalescing to communicate and invite people out, and I'm going to be left out.
Yeah. Well, you don't want unrestricted internet access. So, okay, if you want to have a group text chat access that you can have, you know, at home or in certain times, certainly not unrestricted, certainly not in like your room at night where you'll stay up. Maybe we can talk about that. But unrestricted internet access is the problem.
So that's the core on unrestricted internet.
Unrestricted internet. And what'll often happen is because the kids, I'm telling you, like, again, kids who like typically you can barely get a coherent sentence out of after school, like, hey, how was your day? When it comes to, I want to get access to a phone, they become like a high stakes litigator. It's okay. They pull out these charts and I've graphed Instagram usage among youth and how it connects to whatever. You know, they become like a hostage negotiator, right? Because it's they want this so badly. But the problem then is you're like, oh, I want you to be able to communicate with your friends. So let me just give you a phone. Now they have access to everything.
Yeah.
And that's where the problem arises. The key to the solution, by the way, is you don't have to convince an entire cohort, like an entire grade at a school, not to use a certain technology. You need a core group of about 10 to 20%. And what that does is that validates the option the option of not having access to this is now a valid option. You just have to validate the option, not make it the universal option. And you know, Height's good on this as well. And that's where a lot of focus is now in schools, is having very clear ways for parents to say, I'm signing on to this, and I'm not the only one signing on to this. 20% of the sixth grade class is signed on to this. So when your kid is like, I have to blah, 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 you'd be like, no, we're one of the 20% of families that's not doing this. Let's move on, right? So you just need enough people rejecting a behavior for rejection to become socially palatable.
My key is summer camp. And I cued someone on to research this because I have the last one in the last year of summer camp. And it is a 7 to 8 weeks, you know, New England people around the world don't understand. They're like, do you not like your kids? But it's a 7 or 8 week totally digital detox, and they're happier and otherwise. So at least they get that once a year. And I was like, someone should study these kids that have this versus they don't have it, because, you know, they jump right back into it when they get home. But it's not like they come home being like they missed it, right? I mean, it's very interesting. I don't know where else you have this controlled experiment where generally 14, 15, 16 year olds don't have phones.
Yeah, I think it's a great point, right? They come back and they feel fine, and they're not worried about it while they're there. What made this palatable to them is that there was like an external constraint that just said, yeah, you can't use your phone here.
Yeah.
So they're like, great, I don't have to worry about that. And then they get the happiness. So in some sense, it's like we have to create equivalent constraints outside of camp. And that's where we signed on to X. We're part of like 50 families from this grade that have said we're doing this. It's like, then your kid's like, okay, that's the thing we're a part of.
Yeah, a bunch of my friends are teachers, and they are all pushing on getting computers out of the classroom. No one is working. No one's paying attention. Like, just take them out. Give people the notes or whatever, but take all the tech out so they actually have to listen and engage in class.
Yeah, and this is a whole other conversation, but yeah, what happens? I mean, ed tech goes so far so quickly. Ultimately, school is, if anything else, it's the training of this organ that we call the brain. Right. Yeah. That's what it is. Not like what's the most efficient way to produce an answer to this. No, it's like, how do we actually train this thing to think and to hold attention? So yeah, give kids a lot of computers. Another thing they hack, by the way, my son was talking about study hall with some middle schoolers. And he's like, oh, most of them are just playing Fortnite. Like, what do you mean they're playing Fortnite? They don't allow them to play video games at school or whatever. He's like, no, but they have their Chromebooks or whatever. And they all, of course, again,
my thing is they all want Apples because then they can. Yeah, I use Apple messaging and text to people's cell phone. Like that's why every kid wants an Apple in class.
The kids become computer hackers as soon as there's like any chance of whatever. It's, you know, Matthew Broderick from War Games. They're, you know, putting the phone on the modem and doing whatever. I mean, give them any type of technology, they're going to be playing Fortnite and texting each other and doing nonsense.
So last time I mentioned earlier, you previewed slow productivity on the show. I'm curious, are there any similar big ideas that you're working through right now in the R&D department that could give us a tip to some of your, maybe a future book?
I don't know. There's a lot of things I'm interested in. I mean, for example, like a lot of my work at The New Yorker is it's very focused right now on specifically the different ways like technology is disrupting things, but also how we react to that, right? I mean, In some sense, even this book is about that, right? It was the IT revolution in the front office plus pseudo productivity is what kicked off the burnout crisis that slow productivity solves. Yeah. So I'm writing about a lot of these topics right now in my magazine work. You know, I'm exploring AI. I'm exploring sort of content in a post-social media future. I explored recently like the revival of Kevin Kelly's 1,000 True Fans and how the recent evolution of the internet's made that more possible. All this stuff is sort of interesting to me right now.
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, I actually, an idea that's going to probably be my next book is that I'm very interested in why, particularly for people that are parents and leaders, why there is such a dichotomy for how they parent and how they lead and what is considered best practices, right? Because you know, micromanagement is horrible. I mean, any office you're in, it's horrible, it's debilitating otherwise, but that's what helicopter parenting is kind of all day long. And so I'm sort of taking a look at this. Something that I got into an argument, you said AI, because I'm sure you're looking all around AI. It could be interesting. Like, that got into an argument with someone around was like this notion that AI can take away a lot of the really like pain in the ass stuff that we have to do and the hard stuff. But there is almost a catch-22 in that there's a skill in some of that stuff of just sometimes through brute force or figuring it out or doing that where you're developing character and resilience and whatever, that if you start giving that up, I'm afraid you lose that muscle. And then I'm afraid that you're now can't win that game in the long run. If you give up your creativity too.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw an article about that. I think Ethan Mollick had a piece about that, about Yeah, it can make us lazy.
Maybe you just have to do things that you don't want to do because that's how you develop muscle and skill and resilience. Like if you just make everything easy, there's an argument that a lot of our problems as a society right now are because we have the expectation that things should be easy, which was not the historical expectation.
I like that idea too. Well, you could even say it about like video game culture, right? Because what is video game? It's a simulation of the real world in which all the rough edges have been sanded off. So it's like, I can be like really good at this sport after 3 hours of learning the game. I'm like a great shot. It's all about like giving you just enough challenge to press that button of, I want to overcome hardship to learn something new. And it satisfies that urge in a very fake way. And now if you're young, for example, you don't actually get the real experience, you know, like when I was growing up in the 90s of like, I want to be a skater kid. God, this is hard work. Like you've got to do these ollies all day long, or you know what? And now you're like, no, I just got, you know, I got really good at whatever kids play, command, whatever you're playing, this video game. They're made for you to get good. Like you are going to get better at a very steady rate, you know, that sanding off of like actual difficulty. And then you see it, right? When now you go out in the real world and do other things, you're a discomfort with discomfort. Yeah. And I love your leadership idea, by the way, leadership in the home. Like what would it look like if you took the time-honored principles of leadership and applied it to parenting? This is what parenting would look like, especially if the result there destabilized a lot of things like helicopter parenting that people are sort of about. I think that'd be a fantastic book.
I think the only difference that I can see is that there is no 360 review at home, right? If your constituents could speak up, they could be like, my boss is suffocating me, I'm miserable, and they're doing all my work for me and otherwise. At the office, you end up sitting in a conversation with HR.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the profits go down. They're like, your team is doing bad. You're out. Right. Which unfortunately for our kids, there's no way to do.
Right. It takes 10 years to know whether the profits are down. Right. And in a lot of cases. So that's what I'm playing with. Well, I'll tweak the last question here to the current topic. But like, what's a mistake that you made where you think in the past where you mistook slow productivity for actual productivity, or you just moved too fast on something and didn't get the right outcome?
I oscillate, like especially with workload at the, not at the day to day, but in terms of like the things I'm going after. I oscillate where I'll be at a low and then get antsy and add too much, because that when you add new things, it's not bad at first. Like the actual startup of anything new is actually very interesting and autonomous and flexible. You don't pay the price until you're going farther along. So like the last time I probably did this was during the pandemic, because it was, I'm home, like things aren't happening. I'm not going into campus. I just finished writing a book and wasn't working. And I took on a lot of different ideas then, because I was like, I need things to do. And it took me the rest of the pandemic to unwind. I brought on too many things at once, too many projects, because it's that oscillation. I mean, I struggle with these things as much as anyone else. This is a book of like me trying to understand how to really get to the core of slow productivity so I don't lose that thread. I struggle with this as much as anyone else. So I oscillate. I go too low and then I add too much and then I have to fight back and I pull too many things out and then I get bored and I have to add more. I go up and down.
That feels very familiar. So I can resonate. Well, Cal, where can people learn more about you, your work? We know they can't find you on social media, but where can they find your books and your writing?
Well, you can find my books anywhere books are sold, and also find out more about me at calnewport.com. calnewport.com/slow, we have an excerpt from the new book and an audiobook excerpt. I read the audiobooks if you want to hear what that's like. We have that there so you can learn more about it. And then my podcast is called Deep Questions with Cal Newport, and you can find that wherever you find podcasts.
All right, Cal, thank you for coming back on the show. I always leave our conversations with a lot to think about, and I know I'm sure our listeners feel the same.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
All right, to our listeners, thanks for tuning into the Elevate podcast today. We'll include links to Cal's work and slow productivity on the detailed episode page at robertglaser.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure to follow the show to be notified about new episodes and have them downloaded to listen. And please also just take a quick minute to leave a rating if you enjoyed what you heard today, because it's the single best way that new listeners discover the show. Thank you again for your support. Until next time, keep elevating.
This episode is brought to you by the Yap Media Podcast Network. I'm Hala Taha, CEO of the award-winning digital media empire, Yap Media, and host of Yap, Young and Profiting Podcast, a number one entrepreneurship and self-improvement podcast where you can listen, learn, and profit. On Young and Profiting Podcast, I interview the brightest minds in the world, and I turn their wisdom into actionable advice that you can use in your daily life. Each week, we dive into a new topic like the art of side hustles, how to level up your influence and persuasion, and goal setting. I interview A-list guests on Young and Profiting. I've got the best guests, like the world's number one negotiation expert, Chris Voss, Shark Damon John, serial entrepreneurs Alex and Layla Hormozi, and even movie stars like Matthew McConaughey. There's absolutely no fluff on my podcast, and that's on purpose. Every episode is jam-packed with advice that's going to push your life forward. I do my research, I get straight to the point, and I take things really seriously, which is why I'm known as the podcast princess and how I became one of the top podcasters in the world in less than 5 years. Young and Profiting Podcast is for all ages. Don't let the name fool you. It's an advanced show. As long as you want to learn and level up, you will be forever young. So join podcast royalty and subscribe to Young and Profiting Podcast, or Yap, like it's often called by my Yap fam, on Apple, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.